Hello, everyone. Cool. Nice to see everybody here today. I will go around and say hi to each person, starting with Ellen in Florida and Linda, Frankie, hello, Candace, Jim, Jeannie, and Kitty. Alice, Mark W, Marv, really coming along on that basket. Wow. Karen, Amanda, Paulette, Bob K, Mary, Joan, Chrissy, Ken, Bob O, Phil, Chris, David, John, Franklin, Raj, Nick, Soon, Angelia, Tyler, and Ruthann. Okay, cool. 30 people. Announcements. You have a little bit of time left to sign up for the term student program. There's like a one day retreat coming up, not too soon, but check the calendar. I don't know. Does anybody else think of anything else I should announce? Make sure that you are signed up for our weekly email newsletter. It has information on, you know, what we're studying and what's coming up and what you might be able to participate in. And you can do that by just going to the website and signing up. Yes. Oh, and in that weekly newsletter, we're still taking submissions of pictures of people's altars, which has been really fun to see what your people's personal altars look like. And people send a little paragraph explaining what the, you know, why they've chosen what they have to put on their altar. So I invite you to make a submission. Okay. So today, oh, and I've had a couple people ask. So I left last week, and you had a discussion instead of a Dharma talk because I brought my dog into the vet, and she's okay. It's one of those things. I just want to make sure she was okay. Yeah, she's got gastrointestinal distress periodically. So she's eating chicken and rice. So to the title of today's talk is, Am I a Good Buddhist? And, this topic came up on one of our Saturday discussion Sangha check-ins. And I think most of us, at least sometimes, maybe, you know, many and frequently, the thought occurs to us, am I a good Buddhist? And I don't think any of us is expect to be a perfect Buddhist or a Buddha. Just good, just decent, just a decent Buddhist. And I thought it might be fun to brainstorm about what a good Buddhist is. What is a good Buddhist? And not just, and thinking of it, not just in terms of what we ourselves think, but also like if you kind of imagine what do your friends, I don't know if you've ever had this with like a friend or a spouse or whatever, say like, aren't you a Buddhist when you say something or do something? So let me pull up. Pull up a document for us to brainstorm on about what it means to be a good Buddhist. Meant to do this before. Okay, there we go. And I will share So, if I were a good Buddhist, I. So go ahead and just unmute yourself, and I will add some things to this list.
I would be compassionate.
Kind of like in all circumstances, right?
Always, yeah.
I would do my best to follow the precepts, or at least keep them in the forefront of my mind.
You should put would be at the top so you don't have to keep right keep or would so you don't have to keep typing it.
Well, some of it might be would not as well.
But that's true.
I wouldn't fly into irrational rages.
Yeah. I was going to say I won't get angry, which I know is unreasonable, but.
Would definitely meditate every day for like at least an hour. I'd be able to.
Be vegetarian.
I would unabashedly study myself.
I wouldn't kill anything, even an insect.
I wouldn't be attached to the finer things in life.
I would speak in wise riddles all the time.
And I would never speak harshly.
I wouldn't be so judgmental.
I would
I would
look
be
after
more
my
active in my.
body all the time.
What was that, Chrissy?
Sorry, I would look after my body all the time.
That's a good one.
And Amanda?
I would be more active in my community.
I would spend only 95% of my time thinking of myself instead of 99% of the time.
I would be mindful every single moment. Not.
I wouldn't be disturbed by difficult circumstances.
That's a pretty good list. Leave it up there for a little bit.
It's remarkable how quickly it came.
Yeah. I would, let's see. I would be more wholehearted while sitting zazen. I wouldn't just like daydream about the plots of TV shows and stuff.
I would always be mindful while washing the dishes.
I would stop asking myself if I'm a good Buddhist.
I wouldn't fear death.
I would love myself no matter what.
I wouldn't care so much about what others think of me.
I would spend my time in service of others.
So, I'm going to stop sharing there. Good list. I'm going to make a podcast episode out of this, and I will share some of what we came up with. These are like, to some extent, a lot of these are kind of behavioral things, which certainly are part of Buddhism, right? Right action, right speech. But I think for most of us, there's just an even deeper sense of of the way that we are, of the way that we function, of the way that we live, being out of sync with some kind of deeper truth that we either have tasted or aspire to, or something like that, that we are living out of accord with something deeper and more profound. Whether we have, you know, intuited emptiness or boundlessness or non-separation, interdependence, sufficiency, the preciousness of, as Suzuki Roshi would say, things as it is. And so often we're not acting like that. We're not acting as if things are precious, at things as it is, or that the self is empty, or that we're interdependent with all things. And part of us knows, I like to think of it as, it knows which way is up, like a seed under the soil, just knows which way to go. It's like, there's part of us that knows, no matter what we're doing and what's going on, what would be better, what would be a better way. And in some sense, you might call this our Buddha nature, at the most profound level, the Buddha treasure at the most profound level. So like in our Kyoji Kaimon, the verses that we read about the precepts, we say at the source, the highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. So, and then we say in the past, those who have realized the truth are called the Buddha treasure, and those who, you know, teach the truth and stuff. But at the very fundamental, the highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. So our ability as a human being to recognize the highest truth is this Buddha treasure, this Buddha nature within us. And I think this is where we feel that most regret about not being a good Buddhist. You know, even if we might, we know we might make mistakes at times and not be perfectly mindful all the time, but being not honoring that Buddha nature, indulging anger, being inwardly or outwardly judgmental, our lack of mindfulness, being filled with lust or desire. So according to Buddhist mythology, you know, there's six realms of existence. There's the human realm, there's a heaven realm, a hell realm. And according to this mythology, not something that I believe literally, but I think it's metaphorically very useful. After you die, you're going to be reborn in another realm. And so you end up coming face to face with Mara, who is the deity of the desire realm. And so it's a moment of judgment. Which realm, based on your behavior, which realm are you going to be reborn into? And what Mara does is hold up a mirror. So you basically just, like, your life flashes before your eyes, and you you essentially judge yourself, right? You just, you're faced with what you have done and you end up in the appropriate realm. So nobody else is judging you. We are judging ourselves. We have that, we have no, there's no deity judging us from afar. There's no deity that therefore can forgive, right? If we've made a mess of our lives, there it is. And we're going to face the repercussions of that. So really compared to the ideal, we're all terrible Buddhists. And your neighbor may look like they're sitting in complete like peace and meditation, but they're not. This is something that long-term Sangha practice is so useful for. It's kind of a strange benefit of Sangha, but you begin to realize everybody's got their shit. Everyone, even people who think, you just think, wow, they really have it together. They're so smart or disciplined or profound or whatever. Everybody has their stuff. You know, my Dharma brother Kakumyo, who has come to give a talk here before, you know, I felt so competitive with him earlier on because he was earlier on in my practice, because I'm practicing side by side with him and he was just, he only needs like 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night. And he just, you know, he meditates, he does Qigong, he does, he just, you know, he's always like restrained and not hanging out all over. And his behavior was impeccable. And I just was like, geez. So it was hard for me to see over time that, you know, he had his own karma to struggle with. He had his own koans to face and pass. They just weren't mine. And in some ways they might be more difficult. If you can kind of hold it together, you know, in a more obvious way, then sometimes it's more difficult to find out what it is that you really need to face. So you realize everybody has their stuff. And one of the things that I'm not sure exactly where this comes from. I mean, I guess it's just part of that mythology of the rebirth, is that you would not have been reborn. No one would have been reborn in this realm if you didn't have past karma to resolve. Like that's why we're here. If we had, you know, fulfilled everything perfectly in the last life and let go, we wouldn't have been reborn in this form. So there's this question of this human nature we've inherited that is so messy. And one of my favorite books that I've been mentioning quite a lot recently is Robert Wright's Why Buddhism is True. And it, you know, this is one of the prevailing models for evolutionary psychology right now. And it may not be the most up-to-date, I don't know, but I like this prevailing theory, which is essentially you can think of our mind as being made up of modules. They're not really physically separate modules, but they're functionally, you know, there's a module for like looking for a good mate. You know, there's a module for running away from dangerous creatures. There's modules that evolved for evolutionary purposes to help us survive, help us reproduce. And so there they are, still kind of embedded in our brain, and they serve these different functions. And that we end up having competing motivations and desires, you know, because one module is saying, go do this. One module is saying this and so we don't necessarily feel like we're really in control. And all of these modules, not all of them, but they are, because they're so tied to our evolution, survival and reproduction, you know, we're conscious all the time of power imbalances. Where am I in the power structure? We're conscious of our social relationships and we can be paranoid about that. Do these people, can I trust these people? Do these people really like me? Am I held in esteem here? Am I safe here? We can be paranoid about our relationships and about betrayal. We seek safety and comfort. You know, that's really, we have to stay away from any kind of pain or challenge. We're tempted to use others to meet our own needs. Fear of pain and suffering makes us self-absorbed. The instinct to protect ourselves, our children, our tribe, you know, manifests as anger and rage. I mean, this is what, like, we just walk around and we've just got this stuff inside us, right? Somebody cuts me off in traffic and it's like, blah, you know, there it is. It's just this instinctual self-preservation response. So what, fighting this humanness seems like a losing battle at times. And Buddhists are far from the only religious tradition to try to somehow subdue or purify, change, transform this gritty self. So just briefly, this is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Desert Fathers, some pretty austere monks who went off into the desert to, you know, just meditate and focus. You know, they're like the spiritual athletes of Christian monasticism. And this is from an article. It said, according to the Desert Fathers, uncontrolled thoughts are the origins of some of the sicknesses of the soul. They identified 8 non-psychological sicknesses of a spiritual origin, classified as greed of any sort, a pathological relationship to sex, a pathological relationship to money, sadness, aggressiveness, acedia, which is an illness of the soul expressed by listlessness, boredom, laziness. It's a precursor to slothfulness. And also vanity and pride. These 8 generic diseases have a pathological source, narcissism, which the fathers called philosia, excessive self-love. So the desert fathers practiced sobriety, hospitality, and meditation, and guarding the heart, which, as I read it, sounds very much like our mindfulness practice of being aware of whatever is arising. So, I mean, this has been, you know, maybe not the main thrust of religion, but, you know, every religion, every spiritual tradition has some aspect of this, of trying to like fix this humanness. But it's not just a self-improvement project, right? We have that Buddha nature. We know that there's a possibility of something more. We know from our own experience that when we have some measure of self-transcendence, when we witness and experience liberation from the bondage of self-concern, it's a good thing. We know for ourselves. Maybe we can't get rid of the humanness, but we know which way is up, and we know that some things can be done. So there is a teaching in an ancient Zen koan, which I couldn't find. If anybody ends up knowing it, you're welcome to let me know. I couldn't find the original source of the koan in one of the koan collections, but this is where it's repeated by Dogen in a fascicle called Kokyo, or Old Mirror. So he says, living in the Xuan Fa Temple, Ma Zu was engaged in continuous practice of Zazen for over a decade. Ponder his sitting on a rainy night in a thatched roof hut. There is no account that he skipped sitting on a cold platform when stranded by snow. When Nanyue visited his hut, Ma Zu stood up. Nanyue said, "What have you been doing these days?" Ma Zu said, "I have been just sitting." Nanyue said, "What is your intention in just sitting?" Ma Zu said, "I intend to become a Buddha." Then Nanyue picked up a tile and started polishing it on a stone near Ma Zu's hut. Ma Zu said, "Master, what are you doing?" Nanyue said, "Polishing a tile." Ma Zu said, "Why are you polishing the tile?" Nanyue said, "I'm trying to make a mirror." Ma Zu said, "How do you polish a tile and make a mirror?" Nanyue said, "How can you do Zazen and become a Buddha?" So from one perspective, we can't, this human self, this messy human self is the tile, right? And a mirror is Buddhahood, is this perfection, this saintliness, this purity that we conceive of. And practice is not about taking this messy bundle of behavioral modules that have evolved to ensure our survival and reproduction and transforming it into a saint. It's not about purifying ourselves, rooting out and destroying or throwing out our desire, greed, anger, or self-concern. It's not about our saintly module or self wrestling our base self into submission, vanquishing forever our frivolous wandering mind. That's just not going to happen. You can't pick up a tile and polish it into a mirror, or in some translations it's they say a jewel. You're going to polish this tile and you'll make a jewel. It's a ridiculous waste of time to try, especially if you're really attached to some kind of progress or ultimate success. So last week I spent a few days at the Oregon coast, and while I was there, I participated in a session online. So I went away from home so I could really concentrate on the session. And there's something about, you know, a retreat where you're meditating 8 hours a day. And I mean, it's just very difficult for that to not feel like you're polishing a tile. I mean, what else are you doing? I mean, you wouldn't do this thing if it didn't have some kind of purpose, some kind of, you know, try to be mindful and be awake for Zazen. And I think it was, you know, one evening I slept through all the evening Zazen. And then the next morning I slept through the 2 hours of morning Zazen. And I was just like, you know, even after all these years, I was like, geez, really? Like, it just felt like I've just got this tile in my hand. And like, what is this all about? So it's not about trying to become a Buddha or Buddha-like, but about our Buddha nature, which knows which way is up. So then we discover, as Buddhists, the miracle of acceptance. If dukkha, dissatisfaction, is caused by desire for things to be other than they are, dukkha can be instantly relieved by radical acceptance. Just this. So at some point during the retreat, I just remembered, you know, some of you heard me say, you know, when you look out at the world, if you are able to do that without and let go of all of your expectations and thoughts about how it should be and just experiences how it is, it's precious. It's just what it is. It's luminous. It's incredible. It's a miracle that we're even here. And we can do that same thing for ourselves, right? If we really look at our direct experience without any sense of how it is that we should be, I should be mindful, I should be this, I should be that, there's no problem. So this is quite a sweet miracle that we've all tasted to some degree or another, right? You just stop fighting, you stop wishing for things to be other than how they are. And also, when we feel distress about our practice or inadequacy or whatever, like something is awry and not what we think, right? We are wrapped up in self-concern at that moment. Because how is my practice? What kind of Buddhist am I? So there's the I. So one of the things that I found myself doing during this retreat was to sit or to, you know, whatever, to walk and whatever else I was doing with a faint smile. I mean, I'm probably imperceptible, just, you know, but I find I'd be sitting like, all right. And I just put a faint smile on my face because that somewhat lighter attitude is much more consistent with a bodhisattva's or a Buddha's attitude, right? When it's like, whenever we have that kind of frowny energy, that is our self. Oh, I'm so miserable, or I want to take advantage of every moment of my life, and each moment is slipping by, and whatever, like taking ourselves more lightly. We can observe the small self, the part of us concerned with survival, reproduction, power, pleasure, safety, and comfort, whatever, kind of objectively, without shame or flagellation. It's just what it is. It's just who we are, this being. If we let go of that expectation that we should be any other way, and we gain increasing freedom around the small self when we do this, right? We might feel lust or fear or hatred, but we have some choice around what we do next. Some choice about how we interpret those feelings. What do we do with them? So we don't make the tile into a mirror, but somehow that is okay. As Dogen says in Genjo Koan, those who realize delusion are Buddhas, who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. So I always think of this as like they realize delusion. It's not that they've woken up to some wonderful alternative reality. They just have just awakened to delusion. Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he has a chapter called To Polish a Tile. That's about this koan that I talked about. But I was just looking through the book as well this morning, and like, his whole book is kind of about this whole topic, about how to relate to practice, but not get caught in practice, not get caught in that sense of duality that we are not as we should be. So I love this section where he's talking about problems. So first of all, he's saying we should just sit like a frog. If we are like a frog, we are always ourselves. But even a frog sometimes loses himself and he makes a sour face. And if something comes along, he will snap at it and eat it. So I think a frog is always addressing himself. I think you should do that also. Even in Zazen, you will lose yourself. When you become sleepy or when your mind starts to wander about, you lose yourself. When your legs become painful, why are my legs so painful? You lose yourself. Because you lose yourself, your problem will be a problem for you. If you do not lose yourself, then even though you have difficulty, there is actually no problem whatsoever. You just sit in the midst of the problem. When you are part of the problem, or when the problem is part of you, there is no problem because you are the problem itself. The problem is you yourself. If this is so, there is no problem. So this, you know, if you just explain it, if you just say it in prose, it kind of seems like a tautology and doesn't make sense. But in our experience, you know, we can really do this. We can really taste this. When we really just, it's not, I'm over here and I've got this stupid unruly mind. It's just, here I am with my experience. This is it. Like I was saying earlier, this is the plot of my life, right? This is it. And there ceases to be such a struggle, such a problem. But at the same time, we can't get caught in either end of the duality. So I couldn't find it, but Suzuki Roshi also says famously somewhere, something along the lines of, you are perfect just as you are, and you could use a little improvement. So the two ends of the duality are, I am flawed and I need to improve in order to be worthy. And that improvement is an extremely daunting task and I'm not making much headway at all. Versus at the other side, my life is complete and precious just as it is. so no effort is required. So Dogen kinds of, he mentions in his essay this koan, right, which is usually interpreted kind of like I'm talking about, like this practice is about shifting our relationship to life, right? Not it's accepting the tile, if you will. But then Dogen kind of turns this on his head as well and says, without polishing a tile, how can a great sage have the skillful means to make a true person? Nanyue's expression is an expression of expressions. Thus, polishing a tile is making a mirror. Those of you nowadays should also try to polish a tile to make a mirror. It will certainly be a mirror. If a tile does not become a mirror, a human being does not become a Buddha. If you look down at the tile as a lump of mud, you look down at a human being as a lump of mud. If a human has a mind, a tile should have mind. Who knows that there is a mirror that is brought forth as a tile and actualized as a tile? Who knows that there is a mirror that is brought forth as a mirror and is actualized as a mirror? So there's different ways to look at this. This is Dogen's words are usually just meant to kind of expand your mind and loosen your grasp on limited concepts, right? So it doesn't necessarily give you another concept to grab. But I would say, you know, we're changing our relationship to this lump of mud. I'm so touched when he says, you know, if you look down at this tile, you look down at a human being. You know, we're rejecting the human being, which is the only thing that we have to work with. This is the substance of our life, this messy form. And there's a certain sense in which polishing that tile, like you're perfect just as you are, as Suzuki Roshi says, in part because you are working on polishing the tile, because you are responding to your Buddha nature and you are doing your best, trying to be present and mindful, trying to be appreciative, trying to be compassionate. So it's like we're polishing that tile diligently and we're hoping for it to become a mirror, but really like we're manifesting the perfection in that whole effort. So in our imperfect struggle, which is never going to give us the result that we secretly hope for, we are manifesting our perfection. So I'll leave it there. Comments or questions? Just go ahead and unmute yourself.
I took that to mean like that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So it's like if you have a piece of mud that you're trying to fashion into an art, or you're trying to fashion it into whatever you think it is, in the end, the only person who can judge its beauty is the artist. So it's ultimately how you see it, and that's the only thing that matters, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and if you're looking down at that, you're looking down at the human being, looking down at the tile just formed out of mud, you know, that's, if you're seeing that as insufficient, that is a view. That's just a view. And similarly, you could see it in a very different way.
So as long as one senses that one is polishing the tile, then one is perfect as she or he is, even though someone else may come along and dispute that.
Yeah, I think what that comment makes me think of is even though we don't have any goals in Zen, in a sense, we do, on both sides. And part of I think one of our main goals is to make peace with ourselves, is to really clue into and understand our own Buddha nature, that we are okay. And nobody can do that for us, right? It's a journey we each have to take for ourselves and examine in what ways we feel incomplete or cut off or insufficient. And to really discover that we are okay is so healing. And it really transforms our relationship to the world, to this sense of like impossible self-improvement, and to the opinions of others, and to the challenges we face in daily life. And my concrete example of that is just, I like to project a confident demeanor, but I used to be really, really sensitive to criticism. I just wouldn't let you know it, right? Like if anybody criticized me or I experienced a setback that implied, I had shortcomings or whatever, then I would go off in private, right? And be really tortured about it. Like, I'm a terrible person. Oh my God, and it would really just, so the slightest little negative feedback could just, really crush and unsettle me. And I mean, it wasn't an instant thing, but over the years of practice, it was just, I don't know. It's like, recognizing, I guess my response became, when receiving negative feedback, was, huh, that's interesting. Thank you for letting me know, that perhaps there's some way that I can learn from that and become better. But I know I was doing my best. Like, it's a kind of a settled sense within myself. Like, I did my best, and that's all I can do. And as long as I'm doing that, I'm okay. So there became a certain part of me that was would not be crushed or unsettled by that kind of criticism. So I don't know if that's relevant to what you were talking about, but that's what I thought of.
Yes, thank you.
So on.
Hello. I'll be signing off a little bit early. I've actually got like two other Zoom meetings today. It seems like Sunday's the day everybody wants to Zoom. But I've always, when you said something about a self-improvement program, the way I've always viewed this this koan is that, yeah, Buddhist practice is not a self-improvement program. And a lot of us assume that that's what it is. And so, you're picking up this tile and picking up the tile and futzing with the tile. And when you're doing that, you're not doing something else, right? You're doing one activity, your hands are full. And so you can't pick up the mirror if your hands are full with that tile. So mm-hmm. To me, it's like Nanyue is telling Matsu, just pick up the mirror. And quit futzing with that tile and trying to, fix what's broken and, So I don't know. That's my two cents.
Well, and to some extent, it's what's important is not even a particular interpretation, but a question, So it's like, well, if it's not about polishing the tile and to make it into a mirror, what is this practice about? And that openness to that question is what leads us to this discovery.
Domio, I like your interpretation. I had heard that story before about polishing the tile, and I always interpreted it as being if you're always doing and not being, you know. But I like the way you bring in that it's about the effort. You've given merit to the effort that you're making rather than, you know. So I like that idea. Thanks.
Well, in my, you know, my teacher has always emphasized that there's two sides to practice, you know. So there's the either absolute and relative or samadhi power and karma relationship, that, you know, it's not enough to just have some kind of realization and attain some kind of acceptance and internal peace and then, oh, all right. I mean, you still got to try to keep the precepts. You still got to try to pay attention. You still got to sit. Like, so the effort is still, it's still an essential piece of it. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, oh, you can't make a mirror out of that tile, so just accept the tile. So like, yeah, I may treat you like crap, but you know, hey, I'm just, I got Buddha nature, so that's all right. No, that's not what Buddhism is about. But what, you know, basically it's like, what are we making the effort for? If we're making the effort in order to make a mirror, then it's misguided effort. Anyone else?
Well, as Kyogen used to say, and he would talk about this, and he would, at the end, he'd always say, well, just keep polishing that tile. Just keep going. I love the misguided effort. That's perfect.
Yeah. And that self-concern or judgment or all that, it just gets in the way. You know, it obstructs what it is that we really want to open up to. So, you know, even after all these years, even after, 30 years of sitting and going to meditation retreats, you know, I'll still get caught in that, like, duh, you know, trying to polish the tile. It's not working in the, yeah. But then, like, being able to, And this is where, like, you know, I can sit a session by myself after 30 years, right? Because I've internalized all the teaching, right? But like, all right, time to let go of that and just whatever. So that's, you know, a part of my instructions for Zazen as well, are like, you know, throw away past and future. Never mind. So you slept through the morning meditation. This whole being is kind of a mystery. Go figure.
Could I say that I love your haircut? I haven't had a haircut in a year because my hairdresser is closed, but then you managed to get this beautiful shave. I mean,
I just go over and over and over it with the clipper. Oh.
You do it yourself?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. And then I can go 6 weeks and it just gets a little fuzzy looking, and then I do it again. It's pretty ideal.
Well, my problem is I've had hair. I've been afraid to talk on this session because every morning I wake up, my hair is going all over the place. I have to wet it down and I still don't come out looking as good as you.
I know there's some more thoughts out there.
I was just going to say, if you can have no hair and still be that pretty, then, you know.
I mean, it was easy to let go of my hair because I didn't have very nice hair. I had really flat, lifeless, staticky hair, so. So when you are, you know, what about the tension between self-acceptance and effort? What do you do? So I did my little like faint smile. What do you do when you notice, you know, that you're erring on one side or the other in terms of striving? Yeah.
I try to see where it's coming from. You know, like if I'm over efforting, there's probably a reason for that. I'm compensating somehow. Just kind of investigate that. Not always, because I don't always want to go there, but when I have that mental agility and that willingness to go there, I do try to explore where it's coming from.
Thank you.
We've been thinking about the difference between work and play, because I was reading something where someone defined the difference between work and play as play has to be useless recently. And today when I was meditating, I was cranking through Dharma, fitting pieces together and taking things apart. And this sarcastic part of my brain said, working pretty hard there. And a different sarcastic part of my brain shot back, playing hard. and then the tension was gone. So there's something there, right? The difference between work and play is perspective, but the process doesn't actually change.
Yeah, I mean, I was still sitting zazen 8 hours a day, whether I felt like it or not, right? Was still trying to let go of activity. But if I did it with a faint smile, it was just like, I mean, I don't have to be doing this. I know nothing is achieved, right? But then it comes alive. Then the activity comes alive in a totally different way. Ironically, so like Uchiyama Roshi says, zazen is useless. If it doesn't feel useless, it's not quite right. And yet, oh, when you manage to make it useless, it's so awesome. Got 5 minutes left.
What helps me when I get overly critical or too much looking at things too hard is I end up putting the same amount of focus on a patient or someone other than me. And when I help somebody, it gives me relief, I guess. And then, you know, my friends and family always say, oh, you're back to being you again, you know, after I've helped somebody. And it's really calming. It kind of grounds you, I guess. Not the process of it, because you're not really aware that you're doing it. But then afterwards, it's almost like a distraction.
But it's also about like getting you out of yourself. So it's, in a way, it could be like, well, I do a faint smile, or you just like do focus on somebody else for a little bit and breaking out of that. I don't know.
That self-language, that like that wheel that keeps turning in your head where you're just like constantly looking at yourself and criticizing. And then if you bring yourself out of yourself into helping someone else, like your family member, then you realize how beautiful they are. Mm. And then, I don't know, it grounds you.
Thank you. Did you have something, Ruth Ann? You muted yourself.
our human nature responds most to paradoxes, like helping someone else, you're helping yourself. And the biggest heartthrob, sad story, sad song brings us out of ourselves, because then we think, oh yeah, life is beautiful. So Zen can give us that lesson all the time. I'll just do Sazen and just bring whoever I am right now to this. And then I finish and think, oh, I'm so lucky. And it isn't just, I don't know, get me out of the small eye. Thank you for this talk. It's great.
Thank you. Yeah, another thing that I've tried is, I just slept through, 2 hours of Zazen, or, today I was hardly mindful. I was just driven by all the stuff I had to do and feeling stressed out, whatever. And then to go, the little internal dialogue, like Mark was talking about, to go, who cares? because that totally just, it makes the little, self-critical, self-absorbed part of me go like, what do you mean, who cares? And that never means it's not really about, well, I had negative impacts on others, so who cares? Because a lot of times what I'm concerned about or worried about or stressed about isn't really about negative impacts on others. It's just some kind of idea I'm holding about what I want to do or what I think I should do, So then to go who cares? It's actually, yeah. I mean, if you look at that list of many of the things that we did, with the exception of when we're actually hurting others, it's who cares? And really the Zazka koan in and of itself, right? Who cares? Who's the who cares? Who has this sense of self? And I need to be of a certain level of spiritual maturity in order to feel like I'm a good person. Maybe you're not really a spiritually mature person in this lifetime. Maybe you got a lot of problems. So what? That's who you are. All right. Let's say a closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, everybody.
Great talk. Great talk as usual.
Oh, thank you, Joan.
Thank you. Wonderful.
Have a good day.
Yeah, okay.